Hey everyone, I'm Jacob Cohen Donnelly and this is A Media Operator. This show is a discussion about building media companies for current and prospective media operators. We discuss business models, products, subscriptions, advertising, commerce, events, everything to help you build your media business. To learn more and to become a premium member of AMO, visit amediaoperator.com/membership and use the coupon code PODCAST10 to get 10% off an annual plan. My guest this week is Andy Cates, the president and founding chair of Memphis Fourth Estate, a 501c3 that launched and operates the Daily Memphian. In this conversation, we talked about why the Daily Memphian cares so much about reaching break-even on operating revenue versus purely fundraising, the inherent challenges they have raising money from national journalism funders due to this belief in building sustainably, how they've thought about growth over the 6 years of its existence, and so much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Special thanks to Seb Poe for making this episode possible. So let's go back to September 2018. That's when Memphis Fourth Estate and your primary product, the Daily Memphian, launched. Walk me through why you started this organization.
First of all, thanks for having me. We had our legacy paper, our paper of record in Memphis, was failing. The coverage was reduced. There were articles often about Nashville that were not relevant to Memphis, which, by the way, is like having Boston articles in New York or vice versa every day. And we, a group of us, and I felt and feel extraordinarily strongly that you've got to have a healthy paper for a healthy community. And we had looked at trying to purchase the legacy paper here that was at the time owned by Scripps. We had gotten down the road. Gannett, as you well know, ended up buying those Scripps papers, including the legacy paper here. And that was a blessing because I think if we had gotten the paper here, we would have thought we could fix it and that that model would work with hubris. And it would not have. It would have been a mistake. And so we were far better off being forced to do a startup digital paper, the Daily Memphian. And that allowed us, obviously, to also bypass a huge portion of costs in printing. And also to build a foundation that would work for the long term. And as part of that, we recruited the best and the brightest journalists in the market. And of course, we left, some that either didn't come over, we couldn't get. So that's not meant to criticize, but we had an incredibly strong group to start, including the most well-read journalist in the city. And a very strong leader who was well known in the city as well. So well respected. That's a long answer to your question, which is we saw a huge need, and this was meeting that need.
And so, you mentioned that it would have been a mistake to take to acquire, I guess, what's called the commercial appeal, right? That's
commercial appeal. Yes.
You would have said it would have been a mistake beyond just the printing costs. Were there other reasons you think, looking back, it would have been a mistake to have acquired that?
Yeah, I think that I believe, and obviously we're going to discuss this today, the old model of local newspapers doesn't work. And it's very important to start by saying we did a million different pro formas, projections, and business plans around for-profit. So we always make a big point of saying we are nonprofit in structure, but we run this as a business, and we run it like we would any other for-profit business because we need it to be sustainable. And by the way, in that for-profit model, even with the logic of no real return, more of a civic investment, it still didn't work because we just don't think the cash flow that you can generate enough operating cash flow to cover your costs, or if you do, you're barely going to pull it off. So I'd start by saying I think the model for a local paper, and by the way, there are exceptions to every rule. And in many examples in the U.S., you may have a city that's growing extraordinarily quickly or a mega city that can support a local paper. But I think for the most part, and I think we all know this, and you know this better than anyone, we're seeing the collapse of local papers for a reason. And it's not just because of mismanagement. It's because of a structural flaw. One side note example, we met with a friend who's a car dealer who was sharing the numbers that they used to advertise in the legacy paper on weekends, and it's collapsed. It's gone from an extraordinary, a very, very attractive number to zero, basically, and not just because of COVID. And that is, so the second part of that, you have a infrastructure that's based on a model where there used to be 300 journalists and an enormous payroll and coverage areas that no longer exist. So by definition, they're already cutting, and we would be in a cutting business instead of a growth business. And again, out of necessity. So I feel strongly, and our model now is 6 years proven. I feel strongly that the model for certainly mid-sized American cities and smaller cities is this model. I think it's a nonprofit digital-only model if you want a sustainable, healthy paper of record.
So you mentioned that you run the publication like a business, right? So, it's got to make enough money to support itself. But then you also said that a for-profit model wouldn't work even if you were not looking for any returns. So what is it about a 501c3 that makes it possible to make this sustainable, but even if you were taking zero out of the business from a profitable business, you couldn't do that? Like, what about that designation makes that possible?
For starters, it gives you the ability to raise charitable funds, to receive charitable funds. So out of the gate, you have a competitive advantage, if you want to say it that way. That may be the wrong way to characterize it, but you are a civic investment, and it's a very clear civic enterprise with a mission to support the city, not to generate shareholder return. And by that definition, you're going to bring in a wider range of civic investors and philanthropy. So out of the gate, we've raised to date over $16 million since inception of philanthropic donations. And that alone, now that said, what I'm very excited about and proud of is on an ongoing basis. Now, remember, that was to get it launched and to generate enough revenue to keep us going as we launched. At this time, roughly 70%, and I'd say between 70 and 75, depending on some cost variability and performance, but call it to be conservative, 70% of our current operating expenses today, which are over $5 million a year, and closer to 70% of that is covered by operating revenue, which I'm proud of and which is, to me, the core of why we're a sustainable business model. Because I'm going to flip that over and say, I was at one of the major forums in the space at night, and which was great. But one of the things that was discussed at length is how many nonprofits there are out there that don't generate any operating revenue. And I don't think that works. So we've had very energetic debates with some who want a nonprofit model that doesn't generate operating revenue, also known as won't charge for any of the content, and they want everything to be free. I don't believe in that model. I don't think that works either. So we are the only model we know of in the country that generates the amount of our total revenue that generates, 70%+ of that with operating revenue, which, by the way, is subscriptions and ad revenue primarily.
And can you break down the revenue across subscriptions, advertising, subs, and fundraising?
Yeah, the subscriptions overwhelmingly is the majority of that 70%. And then I would say about one-fifth of that is your ads, about three-fifths of that is your subscriptions. The rest is other and fundraising of your annual budget.
And do you view advertising as a channel for growth? Like, is it something that you're continuing to invest heavily in, or is it primarily just like, we'll get it when it comes in, but mostly that's not the focus?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Do you view advertising as a growth channel? Or
I see. Yes. And we feel we can do a lot better with that. And so that's why you heard me hesitate on those percentages, because I think we have a lot of potential to increase both in the subscriptions pricing, and which I'll also tell you is counterintuitive, because we hold to pricing. We don't radically discount it, while we watch a lot of the nationals do these 99 cents for a year, which is what I subscribe to. I've never paid full because they always offer me 99 cents. It makes no sense. I think it really frustrates me, because I think that is hurting all of journalism. It is. I understand their logic. I've heard their argument why they do it. I don't agree with it. And if you did 99 cents for 2 months and you didn't give me 99 cents for the 3 years, I've got 99 cents, and friends I know have gotten it for 5 years. When are you going to convert? When are you going to go from 99 cents to a real number? Otherwise, just do it for free, or why not 1 cent? So I'm frustrated by that, and we don't do that. I think it's also important message to say that content that's quality deserves to be paid for. And like any other product, if you give it away for free, you're effectively messaging that it's not worth anything. So we've been, knocking on wood, we've been rewarded for that. Our subscribers are loyal. We have lower churn rates by multiples than what I would say is the national averages, are the national averages. And so I'm pleased with what we've seen so far, even as we're not ever comfortable with it, because we know things can change. But I feel strongly this is the model, and we want to have this debate with more people, because I think it's important. We want our model to be replicated, not out of ego, but because we think this is the way you save local journalism in the U.S.
And so back in 2021, Politico wrote a story about you guys. Great story. Said you guys are probably one of the best local publications out there. And at the time, I think they said the average subscription price was like $9.75. Today, subscription costs $14 or maybe even $15 a month. Talk to me a little bit about how you've determined the subscription price and how you've evolved that over time.
We started with a price. I'd like to tell you it's ultra scientific, and it's not. I mean, we have some of the same software product that many of our peers do. So we certainly use technology, and we discuss pricing at the board level and with Eric Barnes, our CEO, in a very detailed way, of course. And then Eric and I early on ran probably, I'm not exaggerating, 20 projections. There isn't a simple answer. I mean, when we did this, we joked there wasn't a comparable or a playbook we could go off of. We, of course, could look at other subscription pricing of local media, but that didn't help us, because back to the legacy paper, that was 99 cents. And then we had some national funders that back then and to this day wanted us to provide everything for free, and yet did not want to sustain didn't want to provide us the capital that we would be losing to do that, or foregoing. So to cut to the chase and answer your question, we established what we felt like was a fair price for the content and for the product. It was a test. We were building a plane in the air, and we always say this is a laboratory experiment. And that was the first test of this lab experiment. And it stuck. And we had way more initial subscribers than anyone that we spoke to, including former local media professionals and others around the country. No one believed we would get anywhere close to the amount of subs that we had. Because we have more digital subs now, I think by a big margin, than the local legacy paper has of digital. So we have effectively become the paper of record in a 5-year period. Those words can sound arrogant or overly competitive. I don't mean it to, but we are the disruptor. And I would say, and it's also not meant to criticize the local journalists here. I am openly criticizing the national conglomerators, hedge funds, because they really, 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 in many cases, I think we would all agree, are not focused on the journalism or on the specific cities that they serve.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think if you go back to something you said originally, you treat it like a business and you run it like a business. Business is competitive. And so you want to put the best product out and you want to beat the competition. So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with having a competitive attitude about it. But I am curious, as the commercial appeal continues to shrink, right? Because, I mean, it was significantly larger 20 years ago than it is today. Every local paper probably is. Do you take a targeted approach to trying to convert disgruntled commercial appeal subscribers to your product? Or is it mostly like a, hey, we're here when you're ready?
It's the latter. It's a great question because we're asked that a lot. We've actually more and more tried to steer away from talking about the CA. And we also don't want to, again, I want to reiterate, we're sensitive to the local folks. We're not trying to demean those people that, and I am sensitive to that. But you're right. We're hyper competitive. We've been accused of being too competitive. And I'm also competitive nationally about one thing that, again, frustrates me and we need to be louder about is not getting enough national support for this model. A, because we're in Siberia in middle America, and B, I think there is initially by many of the media elite, and I hate to use that term, but I have to, that this, you know, you have to provide it all for free and this is not the right model. And I just, if you want to talk about sustainability, you have to generate revenue to have a sustainable business. So whether it's a nonprofit or for-profit in structure, in ownership, doesn't matter. You have to run it as a sustainable enterprise that has cash flows that will cover its expenses. It's just that our revenues that'll cover expenses. It's just that simple. And so to answer your question, though, go back to the CA. We do not run this as how do we go beat up the CA or how do we go convert their subscribers at all. We run it as how do we do the best, how do we produce the best product that we can? Most importantly, how do we affect our city? You know, how does this meet our mission? Is overwhelmingly the most important, because once you do that, it'll meet all those other hurdles or overcome those hurdles. And then inevitably, I would say we already get, and we already hear this from our subscribers and our readers. I think there's already been a massive shift to us anyway, even as some of those readers still pay 99 cents to get the CA and monitor that loosely. There's some other, one of the other things I'd add, the CA's print product is obviously falling down, like every city. And they also, it's also not timely. It has to, the way it works and where they're printed, it has to be done at a certain time of day. So, it does not allow them to have a, and this is true of most printed papers in the country, you have a cutoff time. Yeah. So the power of digital, as we all know, is there is no cutoff time. You can constantly update the story, constantly correct a story, because we're not perfect. And you can constantly modify the story as news changes. And so print to me, I mean, I was addicted to print and I was a voracious reader, a huge believer in all periodicals. And again, in the local paper, that was one of the reasons we started this, because we have that deep seated belief in its importance. I never thought I would give up a paper in the morning, a physical paper, but I'm now fully addicted to digital and all, you know, of all the media I read. And so that's an important thing to point out, though, because most of the local papers in the country, and again, you know this, the vast majority of their profitability when they were profitable came from and still comes from their print product that is falling off. So that's not sustainable. I mean, and we looked at that. We looked at, do we do a paper product, even if it's weekly? And the math is just beyond brutal, and it just does not make sense.
Do you incrementally increase subscription prices for your current subscribers?
We do, and we do it, I'd say, in a granular way. in a very targeted way. And then we also don't effectively collapse our pricing power by offering, you know, I don't want one of our subscribers going to dinner with a friend and saying, I get Daily Memphian for, you know, a dollar a year. That immediately, it's offensive to me. I mean, what have you done to your other subscribers? So we don't, I'm not saying we never have discounting. We do, but we don't have this radical discounting, and we're extremely targeted about how we do it. I want to add, one of the things we need to do a better job of, we already offer it at no cost to teachers, underserved neighborhoods, students. We need to do a better job getting that message out and getting those free subscriptions out. The other thing we do a poor job of articulating, and that'd be on me. I'm not picking on our team. But nationally, some of the national funders, we've done a poor job of even explaining we are free. All of our critical content and crisis is free. COVID, all that coverage was free. Elections, free. Anytime we've had anything that is of, you know, that I would characterize as a crisis and emergency is free, is paywalls down. And then the other thing I'd tell you is paywall is such a dirty word. When we went to Knight Media Conference, I joked with Eric, and I mentioned Eric Barnes, who's, you know, I don't like founder terms, but I'd say co-founder. And because a lot of us were, that's again, uncomfortable because we've had such a good group help build this. But Eric and I were at media at night together, and I said, we would have been better off just saying we're in the, you know, pornography business than the paywall bit. Like, we'd get an equally happy reception. Paywall has become such a dirty word to so many of the funders, including the largest national funder of nonprofit media. And I don't get it. It's very frustrating to me. And I think it's a challenge to us to come up with better terminology, because even our paywall isn't a pure paywall. But I'll tell you, that is again why we want to get out there more and more, because we want to have a civil and thoughtful debate about what the structure should be. And that includes generating revenue for your content. But again, doing the mission, the work we're doing to the city, we are providing it at no cost. So effectively, you have a very large group of people paying full ride. And then those who can't or shouldn't have to pay the full ride don't. And that's tricky to execute, but it is doable.
And then when we talk about the funding, obviously the very biggest funders hate the fact that there's a paywall. But of the people and of the organizations that are contributing funds, is it primarily small individuals or is it bigger institutions? And what are the bigger institutions looking to get out of this?
When you say you're talking about the national funders or our existing funders?
Your existing funders.
Our existing funders runs the gamut from hundreds of individual donors to our largest foundations in the city to our corporate leaders. So we've had a diverse group of funders, unbelievably generous and unbelievably trusting. And I want to say something else on that. The other place we got hammered early by the national funders, and specifically the largest national funder that I won't name, probably know who they are. And we were friendly, but very frustrated. They had two things they didn't like about our model. The paywall was anathema to them, and we were DOA on that. And then the second piece that we hadn't talked about is a lot of our initial funding was anonymous. And that, to me, our city is a very generous base of philanthropy on a city that has a lot of great needs. And the thing I find comical is someone giving anonymously is an advantage. And we were penalized for it because the perception was we were in the media business. Journalism is all about transparency. That's not transparent. And you could have Putin supporting you and trying to pull the strings. And I wasn't offended by the concern that who is funding, what are they getting? That's a fair question. So one of the things we offered and we still offer, all of those donations went through the Community Foundation of Greater Memphis, which is our largest community foundation, which has a peer in every city in America. Every city in America has a large community foundation. I know of every donor. I'm the only one that actually knows every one of our donors has been and is. unless in one or two cases, there'll be a pure anonymous that even I can't see. But of the major donors, I've offered the national donors, you can go meet with the president of our community foundation here. He's a great person. And he will sit down with you and confirm they're local. And most importantly, there are no strings attached of any donor, any of our donors at any level, no coverage requirements, no board seats, no dictate, you know, no requirement of any kind behind that donation. And we will guarantee that. So that's the part that frustrates me is a lot of those that get dollars, even if they claim, well, it's transparent. I got money from Exxon, but Exxon wants me to cover a climate change article about carbon recapture. Okay. And I'm fine with that. And you're going to say all that, but how is that better than having an anonymous donation that requires nothing? Oh, and by the way, it has no clawback either. I should have mentioned that. We raised an enormous amount of money up front, because that's also the only way I think you can start this. We raised over $7 million before we even announced we existed. So to have that kind of capital in hand allowed us to start this from a standing start, which again is the business model we tell other cities looking at this. I think you have to have that. You have to start, you have to go big and go fast. But that was an incredibly trusting group of donors supporting us, because inevitably they were trusting us to execute on this, and they knew it was, I always called it philanthropic venture capital investing. It was big risk, but big need, go try it. And I guess you can never say all, but the super majority of our supporters are very pleased with where we are. We're imperfect. Nobody's ever happy about everything we do or everything we cover, but overall, we still have a very loyal and happy base, and a base of donors that don't have zero regrets about starting this.
There is a lot going on at media companies, whether that's media planning, ad operations, customer service, you name it, there are things to do. And that means you need people to do those tasks and managers to manage those people. All of this critical work is resource intensive, and this year, it is sure to get busier. What if there was another way? Enter SEBPO. SEBPO is a leading global outsourcing partner that serves the advertising, media, and technology industries by taking on your organization's repeatable back-end tasks. With staff in the United States, Bangladesh, and El Salvador, SEBPO teams become an integral part of your company by taking on the multitude of tasks required to run an efficient media company. And this isn't just about throwing people at the problem. SEBPO follows an in-depth implementation process that ensures they execute the right strategies and supporting tasks to help your business thrive. Then, they deploy the necessary team and partner with you to train them on your processes. SEBPO will help you scale your business and allow you to focus on the strategies and tasks that require your expertise. If you're interested in learning more about outsourcing these sorts of tasks and more, email sales@sebpo.com or visit sebpo.com to set up a call. A theory I have that one of the reasons local news struggles is because it is oftentimes hard to connect the benefit of local news to the individual, right? I think they sometimes see there's a disconnect. Across the bottom of your site in big bold letters, it says, support the future of local journalism. Do you find that the majority of your subscribers subscribe purely for a civic reason, or have you found a way to connect the utility of local journalism to the reader's day-to-day life?
That's another great question that I don't have a great answer to. That's really good. I would have to say, with the number of subscribers we now have and the analytics I get to see and all the traffic, and we also have a very large number of free emails, which is its own discussion of, do we give too much free content out, by the way? Because our email subscriber list is wildly bigger than our paywall, you know, what those paid. So that tells you, okay, why is that? Are we giving too much free? But I mention that because I think it would be dishonest to say that I believe most of our subscribers subscribe to this because they want to support local journalism. I think that would be false. That would, I'm guessing though, I don't know. I'd have to do, maybe we need to do another, we do different market studies or polls to our readers. Maybe we can do that. I think the vast majority come to us because they feel like they need to come to us if they want to know what's going on in our city. And that is our mission. So that to me is ultimately why most people subscribe to us. Now, that said, obviously those who not only subscribe to us, but are donors to us, obviously do believe in the importance of journalism, local journalism, and what the Fourth Estate means to any community. So I think the way I'd answer it is, I think it's more transactional for those that are just a base subscriber. And then of those subscribers and others who support us financially, obviously they see that this is much more important than a transaction.
A couple of years ago, I had Mike Oren, the former chief product officer at Dallas Morning News, on the show. And one of the things he said really stuck with me was that people who own homes, have kids, go to church, vote, and pay taxes are the perfect subscriber. Do you agree with that?
More or less, yes. I mean, what's funny, by the way, the first paper that I ever read would have been the Memphis paper. The second would have been Austin, Texas, where I went to college. And then the first as a young professional was the Dallas Morning News, because that's where I lived. And so those papers all, you know, like all of us, you remember the first paper, and of course the different national, whether it's New York Times or Wall Street Journal or whatever. And you even remember the ages you were when you really started to have that daily routine of reading the paper. I think what he said is right, and I would say it maybe a different way. And then it becomes a huge challenge with the younger folks who have been raised on social media. But I think it's ultimately, I used to say leadership, but I think that's not right. Civic leadership, certainly any civic leader, political leader, business leader, I feel strongly knows they need to read us to know what's going on in their city. But it goes way beyond that. It's anybody who wants to be civically engaged. So what he articulated to me is right, but also somewhat dated. And a lot of people who are civically engaged now don't have the benefit of doing those things or don't choose to do those things anymore. Didn't you say church was one of the ones he listed?
Yeah.
Well, I go to church, and a lot of people do, but I also have a lot of friends that don't go to church, and the numbers of people going to church are dropping off dramatically. So if that is right, then he is showing a correlation that's dropping. I'm not willing to give up on that. I think there are a ton of people who have a less traditional lifestyle than I do, who feel a deep need to be wired in and in touch. And then that gets into that delicate balance between social media and what we do. It's that love-hate relationship where you get a ton of, and we all have talked about this and you've talked a lot about it. Obviously, it becomes both competition and funnel. And that's its own longer conversation another day. I don't know. I'm yet to decide whether that's something that's going to kill us or help us. I don't know. But going back to this, to your question, I think it's about civically engaged. And I think anyone who's civically engaged finds their way to the paper of record of any city.
Are there specific categories of content that drive the biggest number of subscribers?
Yeah. I mean, yes, sports is huge. Metro is huge. A lot of the things that I like a lot that I would say are really important don't drive subscribers, but you need to do it. Business, but business is interesting because we have FedEx is based here, AutoZone is based here, International Pay. We have, for our size city of about 1.2 million MSA, we have a lot of we have a very strong corporate base, but interestingly, a lot of our readers obviously want to read about the corporate, you know, the large public companies. But guess what? One of our high, you know, we just wrote that or did a story that Publix is looking to open their, you know, bring their grocery business to Memphis. Mm-hmm. And that got an enormous number. I mean, that traffic was enormous. So that those type of, you know, we tell people, we, of course, we want to have extraordinary enterprise journalism and win a Pulitzer. But we also, I always tell people, we're effectively, the Red Cross can't do their work without a really good communication system and radios and mobile phones that work. And the disaster, we're not a disaster area. I don't want to use that part of the analogy. But we are that communication system, and not everything we do is sexy coverage, and but it's incredibly important, even if it's not sexy. And I'm proud of that. And I think that's the other thing I wanted to point out. We're doing a lot of the very basic foundational news that does, that the community wants, needs, and brings them together. And it's not always sexy, and it's not always what somebody gets on a stage and brags that they wrote that story. That's not in any way to diminish the importance of those hugely critical stories. I'm not remotely running away from that. Those are critical also in holding people accountable and exposing injustice and fiscal idiocy and other things. Critical. Hold people accountable. Absolutely. But don't, but I think often it gets underestimated and blown off how important it is to speak to people to where they are and give them news that is extraordinarily meaningful to them on the ground.
Can you talk a little bit about the team that makes up the Daily Memphian?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a great team. I would take all day. Eric Barnes, I mentioned earlier, is the CEO, extremely talented, great person, well-known in Memphis. And of course, I'm going to leave people out. We because inevitably, again, there's too many to name everyone on our list. Somebody that doesn't get enough attention, Robert Davis is our VP of our board and spends an enormous amount of time on this and gives an enormous amount of time. Robert is an esteemed media, medical journalist, and he's been widely published, incredibly good person, and is, again, given a mass amount of time and talent to this. Our entire board has. Another journalist board member is Edward Felsenthal, by the way, who is the recent CEO of Time Inc., is also a Memphian. Jason Israel is our chief technology officer. He doesn't get enough credit, but what we've done with the dollars that we've had, I think, is extraordinary, especially when we compare it to peers in the research we did building this. Our entire newsroom, I wouldn't have time to go through everyone. Mary Casciola is running the newsroom day to day, does a great job. We've got Jeff Calkins is the most read journalist in the city the last 30 years. Jeff is a Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law, Columbia master's in journalism, and left the law practice to be a journalist and starting in Miami. I think Fort Lauderdale, but South Florida years ago. But he's been in Memphis for 30 years. I got to know him through, we had worked on an effort around the Grizzlies, the NBA franchise here. And I got to know Jeff that way very well. And I watched how his voice was beyond critical in that effort. And at the time, the Legacy Paper, that was the place where this whole massively important civic project played out. Because a lot of people weren't for a publicly financed arena and didn't care if the team came here. Others felt unbelievably strongly we needed the team. If you did a survey today, 95% of Memphians, I'd argue maybe 99, would say it's been an extraordinarily positive thing for the city of Memphis it helps bring the city together. But I saw the paper of record, the commercial appeal at the time, that they were immensely important in that effort. And you had to have a strong paper during that effort for everyone to understand what was going on. But anyway, so Jeff, I would throw in there again, I'm leaving so many out that it's a disservice, but we have a team of roughly almost 40 in the newsroom. And we of course have a great support group for that newsroom. We have an active board of 9, all of whom are wonderful, and all of whom are engaged in this. So again, you put me on the spot because I'm leaving so many out, and I literally could spend 30 minutes walking through all of our key team leaders and board members.
And do you think, looking at the team, because it sounds as if the vast majority are on the news side, do you
Absolutely.
View
yeah, yeah.
when you think about continuing to invest, is there sort of like a ratio of like newsroom to business side or anything you think like that?
No. We obviously went, we have Kathy Kendrick runs our, is our controller and our business manager, and she does a great job as well. We run thin on the business side, and we put most of our resources, obviously. And we, again, we have a good team leading advertising and sponsorships as well. But we ultimately see putting more and more of the resources, as many resources as possible, of course, go to the newsroom.
So one strategy that media companies that they deploy is to expand into new markets because it gives you efficiencies of scale, right? You can take the advertising team and try to sell across multiple markets. I looked at the map last night when I was preparing for this, and Memphis is squarely in the middle between Little Rock and Nashville. Could you see replicating this strategy you've taken and going west to Little Rock or going northeast to Nashville, or is it like squarely Memphis and that's it?
We're Memphis, period. But we will share our playbook and welcome, including Little Rock and Nashville, we would welcome leaders from other cities to come here, and we would happily share our playbook, including the mistakes we've made. And we think it's replicable. Now, I will say this. I mentioned Eric Barnes a lot. Eric was crucial to this, to put it mildly. Without an Eric and without a Jeff Calkins, who is ready to come join us as the most read journalist in the city, and without the board we have, and I'd mentioned Robert earlier and the time he spent in this, without some of the other journalists that I've left out, and I feel bad because I can name every one of them. The folks that joined us early and the ability to put that team together, and the fact we had extraordinarily generous people, a large number of both, including foundational support, that was ready to make a big bet on this. And that included a lot of folks in the corporate community, because I'm talking specifically corporate sponsorships. We had a perfect storm going our way. And then the anger at Scripps and then really at Gannett of how bad the legacy paper had collapsed in our eyes and everyone's eyes left the room for this to get going. And, I mean, gave us the platform and the tailwind to take off. And it was a remarkable, we had everything going our way. So it's the only thing I would openly say is I think it's replicable, but admittedly, you've got to have those ingredients have got to be there for you. And I think they are. If you have, again, every city has what I just named, you just got to put them together. And of course it's not easy, but it's doable.
So I'd like to ask a question I don't normally ask, but because I know so little about local media, I think this is a good opportunity for me to learn. What is something I should have asked you about either local media or the Daily Memphian that I didn't ask you that the audience would benefit from knowing?
Oh, wow. I think ultimately what you didn't ask me is, I'm trying to also think of a way to ask a question that'll benefit us. I'm saying that kiddingly. I would go around the national support is what will it take for the large donors to recognize this model, whether they like us or not, and whether they support Memphis Fourth Estate or not. How is this going to play out for local papers of record throughout the country? Because what you didn't ask, but I think you agree. I think if you have to have healthy local papers for a healthy country. I think I believe that. I think you have to have that. There's some that may not agree with that or don't believe it. And we also can define healthy in different ways. And the other thing you didn't ask me that is related to this answer is balance. I think you have to be balanced. I, at this moment, have people in the far right and the far left, the way I would define those groups, who are really mad at us. So the far left says we're elite, corporately, corporate biased paper. And I've got far right people yelling at us that we're wildly liberal and We're woke. I mean, I truly have both of those terms being used from both groups. So I think we're doing something right, because the wings, the far extremes do not like us. Although but they read us. I also get a kick out of that. They don't terminate their subscription or cancel the subscription. They just get mad at us, and that's okay. But what does it take for us as a country to recognize this is the model? And that, I think, is going to start with the philanthropic donors. There is actually legislation in D.C. that is being considered to provide funding for local media. I'm not going to get into whether I think that's smart or not. I think that there are huge pros and cons. But if the money's available, obviously we'll jump at it. But that's the part of this question has to get down to. If you're going to have all this national support, philanthropic support for media, how are those dollars going to be properly and intelligently allocated is a huge question. And then second is how do you allocate to what model? And then how are these things going to be sustainable long term, so that once those dollars are not available anymore, or will they always be available? But what you didn't ask me is, do we still have a gap? You know, when we started this, we wanted to have no gap. We wanted at this point in our story, I wanted to be able to tell you we're covering 100% of our expenses with operating revenues. And this is exactly why we had to go nonprofit, because we aren't there. And I mentioned earlier, we're about 70% there. When we talk to peers, I literally know of no other peer that's over 30%, with no exaggeration. So with maybe the exception being some of these papers like Salt Lake that converted to nonprofit, I'm not including those. I'm talking about a startup, digital nonprofit, similar to our model anywhere in the country. Like, we've got to have them. I've heard of no one that has a higher or equal amount of operating rev. That's going to be the question is, okay, then what's going to happen? How are these things going to be sustainable?
Is there a path to the Daily Memphian getting truly sustainable?
Yes, I think so. I think we have multiple revenue streams, the biggest being subscription and ads. So we're growing those. And I should have mentioned that they are growing. So number one, that path is you grow those into your budget. Number two, you can cut your budget. Knock on wood, we haven't. So that's really important to point out. So there is a model today that, and Eric and I talk about this in our board, we talk about this with the board, obviously, is there's a model today we could try to do less and probably break even. And then we wouldn't necessarily be meeting our we certainly wouldn't be meeting our goals of broader coverage, but then we also wouldn't be serving the community as well. And then finally, if you really look at the net difference of the annual raise we need philanthropically, I don't say this loosely, lightly, or casually because it keeps me up at night. But if you do that dollar amount and say for that dollar amount, and just let's say it's $1 million, I'm just broadly, for $1 million a year, if I told the philanthropic community of a city of 1.2 million that has a lot of challenges but also has plenty of wealth, and I said for $1 million a year, you get a very healthy, very balanced, very constructive, important, civic enterprise that is your paper record, is that a deal? That's a deal. That's a good deal. And I think most people would say, heck yeah, I would do that. That makes me feel good. Like, again, I don't take comfort in that, because that's still a lot of money a year to raise, and that's still a headache, to put it mildly. But that to me is actually sustainable. And I should have mentioned this. When we've spoken to a lot of folks about sustainability, and when we tell them how our budget is the way it is, and I'm talking about specifically in nonprofit journalism, they say you are already sustainable, because their attitude is, if that's the percentage you have to raise a year, you should be able to raise that a year. Like, you're already good. We don't look at it that way, because, again, I look at it as, no, that's a deficit. That's an operating deficit I got to fund. We got to fund. And we don't want to have an operating deficit that we have to fund. So anyway, I hope that answers it. I think We have a reasonable model today that is sustainable, right? To make it purely sustainable, you would theoretically not have any philanthropic need every year.
I want to end with the same two questions that I ask every operator that comes on the show. First, what is a mistake that you have made in your career, and what did you learn from it?
How much time do you have? I've made a lot of mistakes. One mistake I've made, and one of the mistakes I've made is the things I shared this with a college class I did on a real estate project the other day at my son's college. Is when I've sometimes, and I'm claimed to be an entrepreneur, and I've tried a lot of different things, and I'm primarily a real estate guy, and I have an operating real estate business in the outdoor hospitality world, and that was a good idea 16 years ago, and I didn't do enough. I didn't grow it fast enough when I should have. It's successful, and I'm happy with it, but it's much smaller than it should be because we should have done more earlier. So I've, in many cases, I've been too conservative. And I haven't gone big fast enough. That did, in this case, we actually did learn from that and said, we have to go big and we've got to get this going and be the paper record as quickly as we can. It can't be just two people on a blog. And it's got to be clear that we have the ability to grow this thing, but also that we're going to be around, you know, that the people don't have to worry about the lights going off. And on that, I'd say even a specific mistake we made on that, and Eric and I joke about this all the time, we didn't have a lot of weekend coverage. I mean, I know that sounds hilarious, but we really didn't. We were like, well, you know, as we played this out, we didn't have a University of Memphis basketball reporter. It's University of Memphis basketball here is a huge deal. We do now on both those things. But just the fact that we kind of thought we could get away without doing that. That lasted about 2 weeks. You know, we immediately realized we're dumb. You know, so there are mistakes that I would say were as much about what we didn't do to go big as there were. It was omission more than commission in many cases for this especially.
And second, what is some advice that you would give operators looking to grow their media business?
Prayer. But I think steal as many good ideas as you can. We spent a year doing research. And before that, we had spent years Eric had already been in the media business successfully. A lot of the people engaged in the board had already been deeply, or media professionals. I'd say humility and take advantage of the fact people want to help you. And we did that, and we had a lot of very kind people, including Jim Brady, who's now the Knight Foundation leader in his previous life, leader of media, I should say. But we took advantage of the fact that folks wanted us to win, and they shared a lot of really helpful information with us. And we do the same, or we try to, when people call. So I think my biggest piece of advice would be, and I'd say it humbly, would be ask a lot of questions of a lot of people. And then don't be afraid to do a structure you didn't think you were going to do. Because again, I want to reiterate, we started this thinking we would do it as a for-profit, even if it was a really bad return to the investors. And that wouldn't have worked. I'd finish the way I started. I think this business model is so challenged that it has to be this this nonprofit, but almost a hybrid in the sense that you still have to be this. You have to be a rigorously disciplined business manager of the enterprise, or it will not. And you have to have a business-minded person running it and a board that thinks that way, or it won't work.
If you enjoyed this episode, hit subscribe and give it a 5-star rating with your thoughts. If you want even more, sign up for AMO Pro at amediaoperator.com. Each Tuesday, we analyze the latest media news, and throughout the week, we do deep dives into specific strategic and tactical topics about building media businesses. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.